Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms with me, Becky Hogg, and my co-host Neil Denny. And Neil is about to introduce this week's guest.
Thanks, Becky. Tim Wu is a writer, policy advocate and author of The Master Switch. He is professor at Columbia Law School, the chairman of media reform organisation Free Press. He was recognised in 2006 as one of the 50 leaders in science and technology by Scientific American magazine. Tim has written for The New Yorker, The Washington Post, Forbes, Slate magazine and others. He is probably best known for the development of net neutrality theory, but he has also written about copyright, international trade and the study of lawbreaking. Tim has recently joined the Federal Trade Commission as senior policy advisor. Tim, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Sure, pleasure.
So before we get on to talking about the master switch, I think perhaps we should briefly talk about net neutrality theory and what it is.
Net neutrality itself is a principle, now a law in the United States that says that if you sell internet service, you sell the whole internet. You don't discriminate or favor one or the other or block it. And I guess in terms of what the theory is, that's better for free expression and better for innovation.
So you've compared the net to the electricity grid. So how does that comparison work?
Well, no, it's a great comparison. The interesting thing about the electric grid, and one of the most powerful things about it, is it's always been a network that people can build to without the permission of the electric company. So if you know, have a new iron or something and it works better than the old one, you can just plug the thing in, or a toaster, or I'm just trying to think. It's sort of open season for anyone to sort of think of something good that you could plug in an electric grid. A computer, another example. And if you imagined in some other version of the world, the electric company saying, well, you know, we don't really think this is a good idea or not, you can see there'd be a lot of constraints on innovation. The internet works by its design mostly the same way. People have been able to invent something, whether it seems like a good idea or not to anyone, and just go for it and reach consumers, try to sell it. And I think that's important. The net neutrality debate has been about that right, about the right of inventors to sort of come up with something new and try and sell it to consumers without having to say, well, phone company, do you think this is a good idea? Cable company, ISP, do you think this is a good idea? Increasingly, Apple, do you think this is a good idea? This is the challenge of net neutrality.
So in your book, The Master Switch, I guess you background that whole debate against what you've identified as a cycle in the development of the communications industry over the last century or so. I guess the best way I found you characterised it was in the terms that innovation begets industry, which begets consolidation, which then is subject to its own innovation, and the cycle begins again. Yeah. I was wondering if you might touch on some of the ways that cycle has emerged in different communications.
Great. Let's maybe talk about the telephone industry. I think it's a kind of classic example, American telephone industry. Telephones invented in America in 1877 or so, depending who you believe. And it struggles to start as an industry, and it's very common. A new product will often come under vigorous attack or efforts to be bought out or co-opted by an incumbent monopolist. In that case, it was the telegraph industry, who was threatened by the telephone, and so they attempted to eliminate them. They survived, built an early monopoly under the Bell Company, and based on their patent. You then had, from there, you had this open period, right after, starting in about 1900, where suddenly everyone in America, in particular, thought, well, you know, why not build a phone company? Young men would, at the time, mostly young men who were thinking of a new career, would say, I'm going to go out and start a phone company. Hundreds of phone companies, open market, very entrepreneurial, all kinds of stuff going on. And this was the sort of open phase, and they're very characteristic of things. It's very similar to the internet in the 1990s. When, when I was graduating from university, the thing to do was go to Silicon Valley and start your own company. And I even worked at one of those companies for a while. The next phase in the cycle is, as you described earlier, is a sort of consolidation. And typically, people, there's a lot that goes into it, but typically one man and one company, sometimes several, but in the case of the telephone, AT&T and the Bell Company, grew to dominate the entire industry. Mm-hmm. The purchases, putting their rivals out of business. And a very open industry in 1910 was by 1921 a virtual monopoly under one company. So that was every stage of the cycle, invention, openness, and then consolidation.
So for me, the central premise of your book appears to be that students of free speech are as well to look at these kind of developments in the communication industry as they are to law, in terms of how free speech is affected. And I wondered if you could give some examples of particularly where monopoly has, mm-hmm. in communications mm-hmm. industries, has detrimentally
yeah.
affected free speech.
It's a great point. It is a central point of my book. When you talk about monopoly in, say, the necktie industry, you know, you're morally concerned about prices, and perhaps they'll put, you know, an extra premium on neckties. But when you talk about monopoly in speech industries, you have a different set of concerns. Your concerns become concerns about speech. And this has been something that I particularly feel Americans, but the whole world, is somewhat insensitive to, this problem of private censorship. I'll give you an example. The American film industry, 1910s and 20s, was very diverse, very open industry, hundreds of producers, all kinds of viewpoints, simple movies, but you know, sort of anarchist movies, socialist movies in America. Anarchist movies, fascist movies, racist movies, all kinds of movies, every kind of full spectrum of viewpoint represented in film. By the 1920s, late 1920s, early 30s, the industry had consolidated dramatically, again following the cycle, where it was now dominated by five or so giant studios. And at this point, the Catholic Church, which had long wanted to censor movies, saw an opportunity and began to pressure and indeed boycott Hollywood studios in order to force them to accept a production code. That is, a rule, and it's very interesting, this production code. They came up with a code as to what films should be. And the basic idea of the code, this is the Catholic Church in America, was that the point of film is to reinforce the truth, never to challenge it. For example, you could have a movie about marriage, but you could never challenge marriage or suggest that marriage wasn't happy.
Sure.
Or something everyone should do. You could make a movie about a corrupt policeman, but the system could never be corrupt. And everyone who does wrong, by the end of the movie, must be punished. This was one of the rules. And so Hollywood film, which had been kind of countercultural in the early 30s and 20s, suddenly was a different thing. And the most fascinating thing is all the decisions went to one man, Joseph Breen was his name, who had to clear a movie before it could be made. And so you have the entire output of the American film industry resting on the decisions of a single man who is, turns out, a bigot and an anti-Semite, among other things, who decided what film would be. And, you know, it's worse than most government censorship schemes, frankly, particularly because it was a prior restraint, which even in English common law is illegal. So, you know, it, even without the First Amendment, is something people find abhorrent. So you have these real dangers, I think, in a speech industry of industrial consolidation affecting speech.
And what's particularly interesting about the film industry example is the whole Hollywood industry came out of all of the filmmakers escaping the East mm-hmm, Coast to mm-hmm. escape the restrictions of Edison and mm-hmm. that beginning as well, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Right. The men who created the film industry, first of all, were almost all Jews. So the fact they were being policed around by an anti-Semite was fascinating. And Joseph Breen, the censor, declared his mission, Catholic censor. He said, "My job is to cram ethics down the throats of the Jews." Now, this is a self-described job description.
He said that publicly.
No, some letter.
Yeah.
And so, he said, another letter he had, he said, "The Jews out here do nothing but think of money and sex." And he was like, it reflected on something, because Warner Brothers in the 30s was upset about some of the things happening in Nazi Germany, some of the concerns, and they had planned to make a film dramatizing the Nazi regime and sort of highlighting what was later going to become the Holocaust and maybe sounding the warning as what might happen. Joseph Breen refused to let that movie be made. So this movie that might have warned the Holocaust in the 30s and sort of gotten the American people maybe thinking, they're rethinking their, at that point, sympathy to Germany. There was a lot of sympathy to Germany and America in that period, you know, to sort of convey get the United States more into this was canceled because of this one man, and it was incredible the power that he wielded. And the interesting thing is, as you said, the Hollywood movie makers were themselves not censorial. They just wanted to make money, and that was their weak point.
Yeah. So you say that over the next 10 years, and this is going back to, I think, the net neutrality point Neil raised at the top of, at the top of the show, that we're going to see a battle. And on one side is ranged Google, Facebook, eBay, Amazon, all of the internet companies that are a bit like the sort of early Hollywood pioneers that escaped to the East Coast, the open, decentralized, kind of early, early open practitioners, against a new name, Apple, the major media conglomerates like Viacom, Time Warner, and AT&T as this kind of perfect sort of three-legged stool of communications quasi-monopolies.
Right.
Can you talk a bit about what that battle's going to entail beyond the current legislation, you know, what we might see in terms of the corporate maneuvers?
Very interesting struggle going on, and it has even changed since I've written this book to some degree. But yes, there are the companies, many of the companies that were born on the open internet see that as a value worth preserving.
Yeah.
And so they tend to support it, and some of the companies that were born before the open internet have never really liked it very much. And you know, I think of AT&T or the old media, Time Warner, as an example.
And the way it merged with AOL kind of messed that up.
That ruined their life. So they've never really, you know, in their heart of hearts, they kind of wish this internet thing had never really happened, or it happened in a different way. You know, the same technology but more control. And so there is this enormous battle between companies that are deep, more vertically integrated, more integrated, and more singular. One of the real challenges, as I've watched this develop since I wrote the book, one thing I've began to wonder and become concerned about is the degree to which the internet companies born on the open internet might change sides. You know, so does eBay start to think, well, you know, maybe the winning, maybe we should start partnering with AT&T or something. You know, because companies are first and foremost about money making, and if they, you know, they may have some principles, but if they think that the bread is being buttered on a certain side, they may sort of switch sides. Mm. And so there's a question of whether their commitment is actually a real commitment or whether it's a sort of...
What particular developments have you seen since you filed the book that have made you start thinking that?
Well, one was there was a time when Google and Verizon started to become very close.
Sure.
And I filed that right when I was in the final edge of the book. Yeah, I think that it's true. I think particularly Google, there's some question about Google.
Yeah.
Whether Google, it's an open question as to whether staying in power, Google is sort of the alpha, you know, very powerful internet companies, whether preserving that position is worth making a lot of deals to do so. And so I'm concerned about Google's
It's good to hear that, because when I was reading the book, I thought the characterization of Google was very much that it was definitely on the side of open. And now to understand that that was before the Google-Verizon deal that sort of reared its head, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. Although, you know, Google, it's interesting. Their founder is back in charge, and it's interesting to see if Larry will take things differently. They're kind of the really interesting company. Everyone else's commitment is clear. Google has always fought traditionally on the side of openness, but they are in a very nice position, and companies, history suggests, once they're in a nice place, like to stay there.
Mm.
So just taking a step back then, all of the big companies that are now the huge vertically integrated conglomerates that mm-hmm. we all know have all started somewhere in the past as small, some of them one-man operations. You know, why is there that trend time and time again through history to become the big sort of vertically integrated?
I mean, I think it has a lot to do with the deepest level, human nature. And many of the people who run this, I interviewed some of them and read about others who are dead. And, you know, they are not ordinary people who are just interested in, you know, a simple life and maybe a nice garden or something. They're interested in controlling other men. They're interested in controlling minds. I interviewed one of the Jerry Levin, the head of AOL Time Warner, or head of Time Warner, and then
it's
bought
the guy
AOL.
That's now in the Buddhist retreat, sort of getting over the AOL Time Warner merger.
That would be him. Yeah, yeah. He runs a Buddhist. I don't know if it's Buddhist, but it's definitely Eastern spirituality, so probably Buddhist. Kind of, it's called the Moonbeam Sanctuary. and it sounds like a nice place. Anyway, he was saying when he was in charge of Time Warner that his, I think he tried to maximize. He would have his assistant tell him every day how many mines they had touched that day. You know, with all of their properties, so the rate, you know, their magazines, their films, their cable channels, all their media properties. How many mines had they touched on that last day, and could they increase that? And that was the number they wanted to maximize. And so it was, you know, money maybe was important, but him, you know, sort of this, I think there's something intoxicating about that position, and it seems to attract a certain type of personality. So, I don't know if it's a long-winded answer to your question.
I don't know if this is, you know, it's quite an obvious question, but why is this a danger, particularly in information industries?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, partially, you know, if you run a... Now, there have been great sort of emperors of clothing and stuff. I mean, there's attractions to other industries. There's something particularly special about information industries, sort of for the reason I've thought. There, more than other industries, there's a clear sense of power being gained. Whether you can use that power or not, it's not clear, but there is something a little different. The ability, information affects human beings differently than other products. I write about this in some book. I mean, you know, you might be influenced by the orange juice you drink in the morning, but you're probably more influenced by the paper in front of you. You know, and it has an influence over your mind, over how you think, what you think is important. In a very subtle, I mean, it's sort of almost obvious that if you what you read every day has some effect on who you are.
Right at the very beginning of the book, there's an example of Western Union basically swinging an election in the US. Tell us briefly about
that. That's a little more, even more dramatic. It's a story of the absence of net neutrality, the sort of far side danger. The Western Union was the first great American monopolist of information. They controlled the telegraph. And they also had an exclusive partnership with the only wire service, Associated Press, and a bunch of newspapers associated with them. So they were the only kind of group that could provide instant news. And now, of course, news is instant. Something happens in Japan, we find about it right away. But at that point, only if you had a telegraph network could you actually provide instant news, updates on the Civil War, for example. And so there are other newspapers at a serious disadvantage because they find out, you know, 5 days later or something what happened. Or they have to copy the other people's news, which is what they did. So the advantage to being in charge of... And they used that power, which is a quite unobvious power, to try to get Republican candidates elected, A. And B, would use the control over the telegraph network to spy on the telegrams written by the Democratic Party. So very, very blatant efforts. And of course, newspapers are always trying to influence elections, and I think that's fine in some ways. You know, they're right to free speech and so forth. But it's different when you also own the communications network. And you're the only one. There's a real different level of danger that shows up.
And then, of course, 100 years later, you have the Bush administration working with AT&T to potentially wiretap the internet. And that's explained kind of later on in the book. And I saw real parallels there. You know, it's like a central point of failure almost. In a
it's true. And it brings out another point, which is that government often... I mean, sometimes I hope government can be encouraged to... A government should, you would hope, want to encourage greater openness and competition, but they often like monopolies because they can serve other purposes. AT&T was very helpful in national defense in the United States. They installed sort of an early warning system for ICBMs from the Soviet Union, and that was nice. They built all these kind of bomb shelters. They did a lot of things that the Defense Department was very happy with. They helped with nuclear weapons some point. And AT&T later on, as you just described, helped George Bush, President Bush, with the wiretapping program. The details of which have still never been revealed.
Yeah.
No one still knows what went on. I mean, there's people who know, but they're not talking. No one really knows what happened during that period.
It's another really striking thing about the book, actually, is that I sense from it that you believe that legislators have as much influence on the way the cycle progresses. You know, the mood of legislators. Mm-hmm. You cite Hoover and his affinity for amateur radio, Nixon, and how he, you know, was interested in deregulating the communications market. Now, you called the net neutrality law a law, but it's actually not yet passed as a law, is it? Or has it passed?
This is a technical issue. It's a agency regulation.
Right, okay.
Which law for us, I'm a law professor, we call that a law.
Oh, okay, sure. But I mean, you know, the mood of legislators still counts on the net neutrality debate.
I would add to that, I mean, this is, again, technical, but regulators and legislators have an enormous effect. It is interesting in my book how some of the most unattractive politicians had these important moments. Hoover and Nixon, two of the worst presidents in the 20th century, two of the most important for communications policy. One ushered in open radio, the other opened the cable networks. Fascinating. And actually, Nixon, to some degree, gets some credit, to my mind, for the internet.
Yeah.
There's a number of people who were important. Kennedy funded the early research. Nixon, however, started the campaign against AT&T, which I think was necessary to the birth.
And of course, I guess when you were writing this, you had no idea that you would later be invited to work at the FTC, and I suppose a lot of people have had fun reading the book with that knowledge. You say two things which I find really interesting in the book. One, that corporations of the size of Viacom and Time Warner might once have attracted the attention of antitrust regulators. You also come out and call Google a monopoly. So yes, I guess my question is, if you could launch antitrust, if you were a 1970s judge who was, you know, zealous about competition, and you could launch an antitrust suit against one or the other, which one would you pick?
Let me clarify that I'm speaking in my own personal capacity.
Sure, of course.
And, not on behalf of the Federal Trade Commission. Maybe instead of answering that question directly, I'll tell you how I approach these problems. First of all, I do think that many of the internet companies have become monopolies. Mm-hmm. But under American law, having a monopoly earned by merit is not illegal. You have a great product. Google is a great example of that. Almost everyone uses it. It's not because they've tricked us or something, or, you know, foisted it on us. Or
gone around ripping out telephone wires the way AT&T did at the beginning.
They didn't do any you know, sneaky deals, or they created a great product that everyone likes, so everyone uses it. So they have a really earned monopoly, is the phrase. They earned it. But the question is, once you have it, you're not allowed to abuse it. And I'm very interested in the issue of succession. That is to say, does Google's monopoly remain earned, or is it something that they have entrenched themselves with? And entrenchment is the real key, preventing entrenchment. So measures taken to make it harder for anyone to challenge the company that are anti-competitive, that's what we're on the lookout for. I'm not really, I mean, if I were, again, speaking on my own behalf, if I could just I think I'll refrain from commenting on that.
Actually, it's interesting, because I know most people are going at you now asking you about Google. I'm more interested in the way that you talk about Viacom and Time Warner and the other media conglomerates, and the way that they have, as Neil said at the beginning, started as this kind of rebel industry for Hollywood. Now I see them as one of the biggest enemies to the open net.
No, thank you. Thank you for focusing on them, because I do agree they kind of slip under the radar screen because they don't seem as exciting or sexy as Google, and they sort of seem declining. But somehow along the line, antitrust law essentially gave up on the idea that conglomerates can ever be a problem. And I think that should be reexamined.
Yeah.
You know, when one company owns all these different media properties, I think that, and it's just happened without any real scrutiny whatsoever. Just, okay, they own everything and that'll be fine and they'll help each other out. I don't know. Particularly, I'm concerned about the vertical issues.
Mm.
When people own movement of information and production of information, I think there's an inherent conflict of interest, similar to Western Union we talked about earlier. Yeah.
So let's finish off then by talking about that. Talk about the idea, your ideas of separation of those things.
Sure.
What should we do about this?
Yeah, well, separation principle is the end of the book, and it suggests, as I just did, that it's important to keep some separation between the carriage of content and the creation of it. And I see it first and foremost as an ethical principle that, you know, people around the world should say this is important, rather than the sense that a newspaper, news and editorial are kept separate. And they're kept separate, usually, on the idea that editorial is mixed up with news. It'll start to distort and corrupt the news-gathering process. You know, you'll start gathering information about the paper's enemies and not about the, you know, and that happens, but it's not a, I don't think anyone thinks it's a great thing. So news and editorial separations. There's all kinds of separations we have. In America, church and state, of course, is seen as important, both to protect the church and the state. The idea that the state will become enforcer of religious principles, and that the state will also make the church into something boring or lose its vitality. They're both seen as important. So I think there's a fundamental divide that's really important between the people who move information, doing that in a neutral way. Back to that electric network idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their job is just to move stuff around, and then someone else is the one in charge of content. I think that's really important to free speech in our age, almost more important than some of the free speech laws.
Yeah. So we're talking there, okay, so there's my broadband provider who is the owner of the infrastructure, and then there is, say, I don't know, YouTube, who is providing
right.
information. You talk about a third group, which is the people that actually control how this information is accessed. So
yeah,
are we
right.
talking here about censorship? Are we at a government level here? Say China or something, which is controlling what, you know, certain amounts of information that can be accessed.
Oh, but the third group I had in mind actually was device makers. I had in my mind.
Okay.
When
so
I wrote
iPod.
That, iPods. I mean, we don't think of it much because computers are not designed to be sensorial. But
mm-hmm.
actually, with the rise of tablets, particularly the iPad, you can see another level of control there that is also somewhat dangerous. And Apple's integration, I think, poses some dangers. If Apple continues to decide it is the gatekeeper of what is kosher and not, you know, depending on how powerful they become, that's a serious issue, to my mind.
So an example of that would be, you know, the Apple's App Store,
right.
which is very, very tightly regulated.
Right. I mean, they do have a lot of apps in it. I've taken a very careful look, but they also, you know, have discretion to say no to anything. And I guess that's okay when Apple was sort of an outsider and so forth, but if that is the internet of the future, or the whole story, you know, the computer programs are gone, it's only apps on the iPad, you know, if in that conceivable future, it is unusual to have that level of control by one company. It's not unusual, because it's happened before in history, but it's something I don't think is consistent with the ideals of the internet.
Let's have a quick look at how that, you know, how that in itself could be a problem. Being a geek, I have an Android phone, not an iPhone, and you know, Android can be, the applications can be made by anybody, it's
mm-hmm.
much less regulated. But then on the other hand, you also hear talk of how that very fact makes it much more complicated
mm-hmm.
to produce the apps. So I wonder in that case how Apple, as being extremely regulated on who can produce apps, is actually stifling innovation, because it seems, you know, if something's easier to produce in the first place, you're more likely to be innovative.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there's always trade-offs, I have to admit, with these purely open systems. There's always trade-offs. I'm not sure if the developers do regard Android or Apple as more difficult. The ones I know complain about the Apple process because they have to go through Apple's very complicated and unpredictable approval mechanism. So maybe it's slightly technically harder on Android, but you know you're not going to just put, you know, all this effort into it for years and just get rejected. So that's a different thing. So technical challenges, maybe more, but the relational challenges. I mean, Apple plays favorites. They like
mm-hmm.
some companies. They don't like others, and they decide what they like. But there are trade-offs. Like, a lot of consumers prefer Apple. I use a lot of Apple products, too. No, I don't, with some limits. The history of monopoly is all about, less, some of it is about sort of machinations and secret deals, but a lot of it is about consumer, often the consumer sort of safer product, basically offering, promising that the trains will run on time.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a strong human desire for order, and in some ways, you know, a master or something. That's why the book's called The Master Switch. At some deeper level, this book is all about the human craving for authority and domination and things like that. I mean, it's sort of buried in there, but that's kind of what the book is about, is that sort of demand, you know, when things get confusing, people want someone to take care of everything for them, and therefore, now in politics, that leads to dictatorships and so forth. In consumer products, it leads to
worship of Steve Jobs.
That kind of thing, yeah. Overstated, but something like along those lines. Yeah.
Excellent.
I think that's a perfect point for us to end on.
Yeah.
Tim, thanks for speaking to us.
It's appreciated. It's been fun.
Thanks, Tim.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.